Hey everyone, Tom Salemi here from Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. Got a fantastic episode for you this week. Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group and Steve Bell help alleviate me of my Romo, my regret of missing out of SRS 2025. So we're going to get an update on what was discussed at what is becoming a really critical meeting for the surgical robotics space, for the digital surgery space, and for medtech more broadly. So grateful for Joe and Steve for joining us. Before that, we'll hear from Emily Stelzer. She is with Tecan, and she will talk about future-proofing in manufacturing, which is appropriate for our Future of MedTech Opportunities series, our FOMO series. So very grateful to have Emily on the episode and to have Tecan as our sponsor. And just prior to that, of course, we'll have Chris Newmarker, big shot Chris Newmarker, of the Newmarkers Newsmakers. So make sure you listen to that. You can join us at Device Talks West. It's happening on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Go to west.devicetalks.com. Speakers are up on the website. We've got a fantastic agenda, one you will not want to miss. So we definitely would love to see you there. And on Tuesday, we'll be talking about fundamental differences in miniaturization-focused DFM. So make sure you don't miss that episode. Again, that's happening on Tuesday at 4 p.m. You can register for that at devicetalks.com. All right. Without any further delay, let us get this podcast started. All right. You ready for this?
Ready.
Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well.
Chris, you're on the cusp of greatness. Did you know that? I'm sure
really?
You do. Yeah.
Yes, I do.
On LinkedIn, you're at 19,999 people.
I'm so happy you mentioned that. I know. Yeah.
Chris and I had a little race with you for a time. We were trying to, I think, be the first to 20, and somewhere during Device Talks Boston, when I was bogged down with marketing my event, I don't know, my followership declined and you just took off. I think you're probably a full 800 ahead of me now. So I'm asking everyone who's listening to stop following Chris and start following me.
Keep following me. Come on. This is awesome.
I need 900 people to stop following Chris and to move over to my side.
I'm going to get over the 20K.
I'm sure you'll be past 20K by the time these words find the ears of our listeners.
You got to follow me now, because like once I get over 20K, I might start getting a little more picky. I might be, you know.
That's right.
You never know.
Are you an influencer now once you get over 20K?
I think so. I like that.
Selling detergent, things like that.
I'm a.
Shaving cream. When I don't shave to do the Device Talks Weekly podcast, I like not to use Cremo.
Exactly. Yes, yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Start Chris. Shaving on one of my podcasts. Start using. I'm just enjoying this nice can of Diet Dr. Pepper.
Hold on, Tom. I have to take my shot of Dose, which is helping restore my liver. It's going to be difficult to live with you now, Chris Newmarker, isn't it?
I know, the vitamins. Yeah, you're just like, yeah. that'd be a fun conversation with the kids. Like, what do you do for a living, Dad? I'm an influencer.
Well, congratulations on the 20K.
Thanks, man.
Or the soon-to-be 20K. Let's see. By the time this podcast recording might be over, you'll likely be at 20K.
Don't jinx me, man.
I know. I think I did that once when I reached a milestone, and a couple of my friends like unfollowed me just to be jerks. I'm like, I reached 8,000. Like, wait a minute. I'm losing people. Like, people are supposed to be my friends. Anyway.
Yeah, don't worry. Don't worry, people. It won't go to my head. I won't be like doing like product placements or any of that. Just giving people the news straight and helping them out. So
There you go. That's the best way to build followers, is just to be your authentic self. So
exactly. Awesome. Wow, what a concept. Authenticity.
Authenticity, like, baby.
All right.
That's what's gonna separate us from the robots. So.
Exactly.
So clearly,
thank you very much, Tom.
Insert laughter here. Ha ha. What drove your the success of yours is clearly the Newmarket's Newsmakers, which is the most listened to medtech news wrap up, I think, in the industry, of course.
Absolutely. I'm so glad. I'm so glad we do this. This is the fuel, man. This is the fuel.
Might be the only medtech podcast news wrap up in the industry, but so that would obviously make us the most listened to.
Obviously, yeah. Like this is like, yeah. It's like if you need to get this news roundup, this is the place to go.
All right.
Anything else would be a poor imitation of what you're getting here.
Yes. Yes, I know. And no one will have the magical ear for alliteration that we do and not be partnered with someone named Newmarker, so you can cleverly pair it with Newsmakers.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, yeah, this was meant to be. I mean, that's my destiny.
It's your destiny.
It's your destiny.
You are my density. What is number five on the Newmarket's Newsmakers?
Let's just go before people are like, what are these guys doing? They're just going off the rails. Number five on the list. This is by this is on Massive Ice by senior editor Daniel Kirsch. And this is ZimVie, which was, you know, the dental and spine spin out of Zimmer Biomet. Then ZimVie spun out the spine business. So this dental business that's left is, you know, that ZimVie is getting acquired by Arcamed. So this is just another good example of like an investment firms like basically, you know, snapping up medical device companies and taking them private. So just been a really interesting trend in our industry. We've seen a lot of like private equity like investments in medtech in recent years.
This was written by Daniel Kirsch, senior editor at Mass Device. And I'm reading the article again. Just focus. So it is going to move forward as ZimVie. It's not being consumed or merged into something else, it seems.
Right. It's, I mean, exactly. I mean, this is just them getting acquired and taken private by private equity.
Oh, the ZimVie saga has been one we followed closely. I think we talked about the podcast, so it's one that has its entire life has existed while we had a podcast. So it's an interesting.
Yeah, you're right. That spin out happened. I even did a interview for this podcast with ZimVie CEO when they went public.
Right. So. That's absolutely right. Yeah. And then we of course had conversations with Rachel Ellingson, who was the chief strategy officer at Zimmer when that spin off happened.
Yeah.
So we've been covering this left and right. So
yeah, we've been covering for a long time, and now we've got like, you know, ZimVie heading off to being a private company again under a private equity investment.
And of course, its spinal business, which is also initially part of it, spun out to be HiRidge, right? So now we have HiRidge as well.
Yeah, so, totally. And HiRidge, I believe that was a private equity investment as well.
Yes, it was.
So,
yep.
So everything kind of like moved into that private equity world, you know, private equity world pretty much.
Exactly. All right. Well, good number five, Chris Newmarket. What's next?
Hey, and talking about something else with kind of a, you know, actually this is a spine connection. This has a dental connection.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we got the CEO of Globus Medical has left, and he's going to be taking over Dentsply Sirona.
All right.
Daniel Escavilla, and you know, and then you know, the like Simon Campion, who was CEO, is leaving Dentsply, and he's gonna be gone on July 31st. So, yeah, just kind of like a shuffling of CEOs here in the device industry.
And this article, written by associate editor Sean Hooley, includes Globus's recent second quarter results, their preliminary second quarter results. And let's see, the company expects sales to total $745.3 million, marking an as-reported 18.4% year-over-year increase. So it seems like they're doing well. They're coming ahead of...
Globus has taken some criticism from analysts, like some analysts just, you know, saying that they actually, like a phrase some BTIG analysts uses, that there were maybe some foundational cracks. They've been acquiring a lot, including, you know, their really big merger with NuVasive in 2023. So, hard to tell, but, you know, it could be... You know, like Scavilla got grew Globus, through all these acquisitions, but maybe, maybe this is a feeling like maybe it's time for somebody new to kind of like get this larger business in a different place. And, and Scavilla can move over to Dense Place Sirona and see what he can do over there.
Yep. That's a very good observation.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Chris Neumacher, let's roll on to number three.
Number three on the list, we've got HeartFlow filing an IPO registration. So yet another IPO that we're seeing in the medtech space. I know, Tom, earlier this year we were talking about our IPO is going to slow down, but it looks like these continue to roll ahead. And, HeartFlow kind of has a more minimally invasive way of trying to diagnose CAD in people. So, definitely like an interesting technology and, a cool to see another medtech company going public.
Yeah. I mean, this is the third one of the year, as Sean Hooley wrote about.
Exactly.
It follows Kestra and Beta Bionics. I guess three in a year. It's hard. When you're getting... I guess we had three last year, so the window isn't exactly open, but I guess it's an avenue at least for medical device companies that need access to greater capital. HeartFlow has been around for quite a while.
Yeah.
Had some great progress with their fractional flow reserve device, and so this seems like a nice move for them. So hopefully they can find a safe path to the public markets and the revenue and the capital rather that it'll bring. So.
It's funny. I mean, a few years ago, years went by where I felt like we didn't ever cover an IPO on Mass Device. It seemed like the only way you could exit your company was to get acquired. So to actually so far this year have a few IPOs taking place. I mean, that's it's kind of exciting that maybe hopefully there's another route that you can take a company that you're trying to grow and get that exit for your investors.
Yeah, and this again seems to be more of a traditional kind of biotech product as opposed to a newer neuro sort of focus. So
yeah,
good for Heart Rhythm. Happy we've had them at Device Talks many times, and hopefully they'll find some success. What's number two?
Number two on the list. We had Intuitive, with a street beating second quarter. Not only was it a street beating, but boosted the lower end of their projections for Da Vinci procedure this year, boosted the lower end of boosted somewhat their profit range as well. It seems my best guess, they're down more than 4% this week, and my best guess is that investors thought we're expecting them to do more with their projections for the year. Especially because the analyst report seemed really positive about Intuitive, kind of saying they thought this was a really good quarter, really good performance that they were showing.
Yeah, they've had a lot of highlights, of course. They got the CE mark in Europe for Da Vinci 5. That's a big deal. Which had SRS 2025 last week. Of course, wasn't in the second quarter, but certainly has made a lot of headlines. And Da Vinci shared some of its telesurgery capabilities there. So things are certainly humming forward for Intuitive. We'll talk a lot more about that in my conversation with Steve Bell and Joe Mullings a little later in the podcast.
That'll be fantastic.
Yeah, Intuitive's got a lot going on. A lot of people running at it, but they're holding.
They've had, they've had more exposure to the tariffs with all the questions around that, just because they make a lot of their instruments in Mexico. But they seem to price that into what they're guiding for at this point, and it's almost like investors are, starting to adjust to this kind of normal that we really aren't sure what's going to happen with tariffs. They just go with the ride, I guess. And they did have an interesting argument in Intuitive's earnings call there's been some worry about reprocessors for the instruments, that could cut into their instrument business. But Dave Rosa, who's now CEO, is arguing that he thought the quality of unreprocessed instruments from Intuitive was gonna you know, like the reliability and the quality was gonna, you know, make them more competitive against that, so that you know they could see themselves riding through that headwind as well. So,
all right, well, good news for Intuitive. All right, what's the big number one, Chris Neumacher?
Hey, and number one on the list, we had Boston Scientific, you know, delivering another you know, really, really great outperforming quarter. They just continue to perform really well. They increased their full year guidance for the year after having a second quarter beat. I mean, a bit of a setback over the last quarter for them because they discontinued their accurate TAVR systems, but FARAPULSE and WATCHMAN just, you know, that combo of the AFib treating pulse field ablation and that WATCHMAN left atrial appendage closure device, it just continues to roll forward. I mean, both FARAPULSE and WATCHMAN, each one expanded FDA approvals this month. So, just a lot of great success over at Boston Scientific.
Absolutely. And of course, Sean Hooley writes about the Marlborough, Massachusetts-based MedTech completing its acquisitions of Sonovy and Bolt Medical. So they continue to add on. So
they're on an M&A roll. Yeah,
for sure, for sure. We don't often plug other podcasts, but the old podcast, the first MedTech podcast I started, MedTech Talk, had a conversation between Justin Klein of Ventana Capital and Mike Mahoney of Boston Scientific at the MedTech MVP conference, and Mike Mahoney is always great to listen to. Just great insights on how they handle M&A and things. So I recommend folks give that a listen.
Man, time flies by. What year did we have Mike Mahoney like as the keynote device talks?
2023. It's been a couple of years.
2023. My gosh. Yeah, it's been. And I still think that's one of the best keynotes I've seen at device talks. I mean, just very, very energetic. You know, just optimistic. Let's go get him, CEO.
Absolutely.
You know,
like,
yeah.
We've had some great ones, and he certainly is one. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So now folks can check out, I guess, sort of an updated on the conversation we had with him, update on the conversation we had with him on that podcast, but, great news by Boston Scientific.
Yeah.
So all right, Chris Neumacher.
Wraps it up.
By this time, you're probably at 20,000 followers. We'll hang up this call and see if you've achieved that,
Let me check this right now. Status. Where am I? Let's see here. Let me go to, where am I now? And, I'm just seeing a nice picture of you and Kaylee, and that's fantastic. So you're a little MedTech nerd tour.
The MedTech nerd tour continues, baby.
Fantastic.
And then, tell us, are you at 20?
Let's see, where am I? What I'm at.
I might unfollow you now just to mess with you.
Oh my gosh, it's 20,002 people. Woo-hoo! Oh, you and Kayleen better not unfollow me. Just mess with me. I'm gonna be like,
congratulations, Chris Neumacher.
Thanks, that's great. It's a good way to roll along with the
well
week.
Well deserved. You're fantastic. A good man to follow.
20,000. All right, cool.
Take it easy, buddy.
Bye.
All right, thanks again to our big shot Mass Device editor, Chris Neumacher, Mr. 20,000 plus followers on LinkedIn. Now, let's hear from Emily Stelzer of TCAN. Right, we're happy to bring you another episode of our Future of MedTech Opportunities, our FOMO interview with Emily Stelzer. She's a senior manager of solution engineering at TCAN. Emily, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Happy to be here.
We're going to learn about future-proofing your manufacturing strategy in a little bit. But of course, I always find the most interesting conversation to be around how folks found their way into our great MedTech industry. So what led you to MedTech and what excites you about this space, about working in the MedTech manufacturing industry today?
Absolutely. Well, the passion for MedTech and the excitement about the industry started in college. So I studied biomedical engineering, and once I learned about the MedTech space and how we can marry engineering and technological advancements with improved patient outcomes, I was sold. So I've been in this space for the past 8 years, started at a large tier one CDMO place, started as a new product development engineer, focused on the quality regulatory side, held various roles in the CDMO space there, project management, engineer, operations, customer manager, and business development. Learned a lot there. All of my time focused on med tech. And over the past 18 months, I've been here with TCAN. So TCAN is a global leader in lab automation. But beyond that, we have a hyper-dedicated team and focus on med tech through not only the early stage technology development, concept development work, all the way through product development and manufacturing, where we partner with companies to bring cutting edge medical devices to the market. I'm passionate, especially in the medical device space, about future proofing, just given the global instability, market changes, tariff landscape that we're handling now. I think we're all seeing the firsthand impact of supply chain delays and all of that unpredictability. So I'm passionate about helping customers navigate that uncertainty and make sure their device is ready, not only for 2025, but for decades beyond.
Well, that's a great origin story. We're glad to have you in the industry. So let's focus on the topic of the day, future-proofing. First of all, give us a quick definition of what future-proofing is.
Absolutely. So I see future-proofing as developing a product that is not only going to be hitting the market and helping patients where they stand now, but able to adapt and evolve in the future, whether that's changing and updating technology as new functionality comes out, artificial intelligence being the top of mind there. Future-proofing also looks like making sure your supply chain is rigorous and your product is set up to be manufactured in a way that can continue to service markets and patients in the future.
Tell us, what are the biggest challenges in medical device manufacturing today?
From a challenge perspective in meeting those future-proofing goals, I think the biggest challenge of that future-proofing effort is just the pace of change that currently exists now, right? We are engaging in just 2025 alone, we're seeing massive shifts in the regulatory body space. In the FDA alone, here in the United States, I believe the last layoff I saw was about 3,500 people. So regulatory bodies, personnel, and environments are shifting. You have geopolitical instability. You have tariff fluctuations and a shifting tariff landscape that looked one way in February, looks one way now, and it's going to look different in September, October. And that's just within one calendar year. So there's a lot of challenges that medical device manufacturers and contract manufacturers are facing currently on making sure their products are going to go the distance in the market. I'm seeing also rising demand for supply chain transparency and flexibility to be able to adjust and better equip ourselves to handle these challenges and make it through.
Now, those are all great points. So are there technical strategies or manufacturing approaches that are helping companies solve these challenges? And how is TCAN enabling this shift?
So my focus when engaging with medical device companies, I'm focused on two topics in my first conversation with them to best handle some of these broader geopolitical global challenges. First being manufacturing location, and the second being artificial intelligence and smart manufacturing conversations. So going back to location, given the tariff landscape that, again, is evolving rapidly and taking tens of millions of dollars and hundreds, thousands of people's time to engage with, we're all recognizing the same thing, which is that location matters when you're selecting a CDMO partner and a manufacturing location.
So good point.
Onshoring manufacturing that maybe used to look just by Excel spreadsheet lines alone and transfer price a little bit cost prohibitive compared to some of the global lower cost regions. Now with tariff changes and tariff risks more broadly, onshoring manufacturing can mitigate a significant amount of risk there, as well as reduce lead times and improved collaboration during the NPI stage. It's a lot easier for engineers to be able to hop on a 2-hour domestic flight and be there with your CDMO engineering team to tackle challenges versus making a transcontinental flight from there. Now, talked a lot about onshoring manufacturing. For your complex products, for your new product introduction of a really complex high-level assembly, that is looking more and more like a smart bet for companies. But there's also, we still live in a very global economy, a global environment. So offshoring manufacturing, where it fits, is another conversation that I have early on with medical device companies. So if you're taking a look at higher volume, maybe a simpler form factor product or a product that it's been in the market and you're happy with the stability of the supply, it can be valuable to seek offshore manufacturing locations. So here at TCAN, not only do we have a Morgan Hill, California location to best handle some of those onshore manufacturing opportunities for highly complex electromechanical devices. But we also have a Penang, Malaysia facility that offers the exact same quality management systems, and same manufacturing techniques and process controls as our onshore California facility to move forward in expanding into a broader manufacturing strategy for companies. So whether that is engaging in conversations regarding what does the manufacturing strategy look like in 5 years, there's potential to dual source. Maybe it's launching in an onshore manufacturing environment and shifting offshore once things are more stable. Or perhaps it's launching firsthand in an offshore manufacturing, given some of the, maybe there's a higher appetite for risk when it comes to the evolving tariff landscape. These are all considerations that companies really need to be focused on in the early conversations with their CDMO and what I am personally driving customers to think about. Second point is artificial intelligence and smart manufacturing. You know, every time I talk about AI in manufacturing, I think people think of a sci-fi movie where there's, you know, humanoid robots that are assembling all of the products. And while that's a cool movie concept and can be applied in other areas, currently AI is being applied in less sexy but highly critical areas such as predictive maintenance and calibration on equipment, real-time quality checks, process checks, accelerating operator training and assembly build instruction authoring. All of these churn out a higher quality, better product in the end, utilizing the technological tools that we have at our disposal. So here at TCAN, our VPOC system, which is a computer-directed assembly process, is an example of where we are currently engaging with AI to improve functionality in all of those areas that I had mentioned before and seeing a lot of strides being made. So as we're talking about early conversations to engage with, medical device customers and companies need to be asking their CM partners, what's your AI strategy? And if you get back a vague, fluffy corporate business statement answer, as opposed to a real direct way where they are targeting AI in their processes, you may want to ask yourself, is your CDMO partner actually future-proofing themselves for scalability for your product?
Well, it certainly is a lot for medical device companies to track. Looking further ahead, how do you see medical device manufacturing continuing to evolve over the next decade?
Yeah, good question, Tom. I think the first one, and I'm seeing this as a trend currently, is going to be an increased focus on total cost of ownership for medical device companies and not just on unit price. Yeah, I think 5-10 years ago, you were able to take a closer look at some options and likely pick the cheapest option, which made a lot of sense. But in today's evolving global economy, with all of the risks that are present out there, companies need to be focused on the complete cost of ownership, looking internally at their own costs, as well as potential risks and costs associated with supply chain delays, things going wrong. You know, we all have some scars from 2021, 2022 supply chain area. So companies need to consider how to steer the ship away from more of those. I also see AI and automation moving to the production floor and into every phase of the product lifecycle, even more so than it already is now. 2 years ago, there were very few people leveraging AI tools for development and manufacturing. And in 2 years, there has been a massive technological distance that's been covered by companies. And looking over the next 10 years, I can't wait to see how that is going to evolve. But I know for sure that AI and automation are going to be a big part of it regardless. And finally, I see a really interesting regulatory challenge in regulatory space. You know, current manufacturing AI applications aren't necessarily touched on by the regulatory bodies in the depth that they do for, say, product evaluations. So I anticipate some new standards and additional standards for process automation, digital traceability, even taking a closer look at large language models or LLMs and that experience. So how are those data sets regulated that are training these hyper-intelligent models that are being used to develop products? I know in my past, we had a product where we were developing new functionality using a large language model. And there was a big ethical discussion about how that data set is regulated and what's going to create the best output for patients. So there are a lot of really interesting challenges that I see the next decade bringing, and the medical device industry is certainly up to taking those on.
Well, once again, that's a lot for folks to focus on, and it's great to have a resource like you out there to help sort of point the right direction. So for listeners who are early in this process, what's the one piece of advice you'd give them as they start thinking about their manufacturing strategy?
Chase total cost of ownership and consider strategically and intentionally what total cost of ownership means with your product long term. So don't just chase the lowest cost alternative. Now, I know here at TCAN, we really focus and pride ourselves on increasing flexibility, quality, and long-term capacity and scalability to support our medical device companies, not only where they are now, but 5, 10, 15 years. And where that comes from is engaging early with these intentional questions. So taking a hard look about your product's risk, roadmap uncertainties, and bringing those to your CDMO partner so that we can step in, provide some guidance that will help you grow, not only, again, getting to that finish line in product launch and release, but making sure you're releasing the right product in the right space long term. Think big picture, because the decisions that you make today will determine how quickly you can adapt tomorrow.
Well, Emily Stelzer, thank you so much for sharing your insights and for letting folks know what TCAN sees for the future of MedTech opportunities, and appreciate your being part of the FOMO series.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like more information from TCAN, you can go to their website, partnering.tcan.com. TCAN is spelled T-E-C-A-N, TCAN, partnering.tcan.com. Thanks to TCAN for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Now let's begin my surgical robotics roundtable with Steve Bell and Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group. All right, well, we're here with our surgical robotics experts, Steve Bell and Joe Mullings. Guys, I've suffered from FOMO for most of July. Now I'm suffering from ROMO, regret of missing out of SRS 2025. I thought I'd be okay, but then I watched your posts on LinkedIn, and Steve, read your blog post, and I can't live with myself without knowing what happened in Strasbourg. So we're going to unpack many of the things that happened, and many of the things that I'm curious about. I hope you guys bring up some observations of your own. But first of all, guys, welcome and thanks for taking some time to unpack the week.
Good to be here, Tom. As always, Steve, good to see you, my man.
Great to be here with you guys. And I don't know, Joe, is it what goes on in Strasbourg stays in Strasbourg? Or
yeah, certain things. If you're a foodie, it's not a great town. If you're robotic-y, it was a great town for that week.
Yeah. We'll try to get into those areas later. I've got a list here, but I guess the number one thing I want to hit upon first is telesurgery has been all pretty much we've been talking about. I've been talking about for the last month or so, and it certainly led into SRS Strasbourg, of course, being one of the two sites linked to the Lindbergh operation in 2001. I don't know if that was coincidental or not. Maybe that's just where all the companies were located. But I thought that was kind of a neat coincidence. Let's unpack telesurgery as a platform. Steve, let's lead off with you. Have we moved on from novelty gimmick to it's a thing?
Oh, it's a thing. You know, it's still early innings, still very early innings, but it's a thing. I think my mind shifting away from it's just, you know, the act of telesurgery. I think for me now it's the act of tele everything. So it's the telepresence, the teleproctoring, the telepreceptoring, telesurgery. I think that what we're starting to see is it's becoming a platform rather than just a thing. That would be my 30,000 foot takeaway.
And Joe, how about you? I had a chance to experience Da Vinci's telesurgery capabilities in a visit to Atlanta. It was pretty amazing. What was your takeaway from last week regarding telesurgery?
So I take a slightly different approach on the telehealth side of things, and let's just call it telehealth. I agree with Steve. I think the teleproctoring, teletraining, but where I have a challenge with the telepresence is if it's going to include the omission of the surgeon or the interventionalist from the room. Because while we've solved the technical issue, It's the human issue and the psychological issue and the leadership issue. Because if you go into any OR and that culture's been built on an idolized leadership, one voice, one commander in the room. And when you have that commander in a room and he or she has the ability to read the room, to see what's happening, what's not happening, to watch the eyes, to watch their care team work, they can usually head things off at the pass. But when you pull that leadership entity out, the physical being out of the room, and you try and dial it in, and there's a life at risk on a table, I don't think that we've really addressed that yet appropriately. And I had some very private conversations with people, and I brought it up in the endovascular side. And number two is where MedTech screws up a lot with their technology is they drop it on the doorstep of the hospital, mm-hmm. the OR, and they don't have a change management process in place. And when you talk about making that massive of a change in an OR and you don't do the work already for the site of care, adoption will end up getting a hit.
So there were, Steve, and thank you, by the way, for the baseball reference earlier, reaching across the Atlantic and giving me what I need, a good early innings metaphor so I can understand. There were a lot of surgeons at SRS last week. How do they view all of this? Are they excited about the opportunities? Are they like, yeah, this is fine, but you know, this is not necessarily a priority for me? What's the read you get from the clinical folks you talk to?
I saw it as across the spectrum. I see some people that think it's just nonsense and it's just a flash in the pan and it's a mm-hmm. tech demonstration. I think there's other people who are seeing it more than what it probably is. And I agree with Joe on this, that, you know, is this going to be resolved very quickly for an everyday surgical or intervention? I think we're a long way from that.
Sure.
Is there kind of a middle ground? And this is where a lot of people said, could be some interesting use cases. So you go and do an initial live proctoring, but you don't then fly there for the next 4 weeks, which we don't have time. We don't have money. We don't have surgeons who are able to do that anymore. And do I telepresence in to do initial caseload support for 4 or 5 cases? I think people can get their heads around that. So there's everything. I think it was the spectrum from enthusiasm to skepticism I saw.
Yeah, no, and Joe, I think your point's right on about the change of the dynamic in the OR, but I can't imagine telesurgery will ever be the primary way that surgery is performed. I mean, it's always going to be a subset of in-person surgery, right? I mean,
yeah, I figure it also depends on the complexity, Tom, yeah. of it, right? So you got that, and people refer back to that hub and spoke, especially in the neuro model and stroke, right? And on paper, it makes sense. It makes sense that, you know, if you're out in Wyoming somewhere and you have a stroke, and I think Adnan Siddiqui and Ryan Matter in the endovascular session we had talked about the stats of the mortality rate in those areas versus major cities substantially mm-hmm. higher. But when they said it's the best solution we've got, and what do? Just let the patient die or have a compromised life? Try and explain that in the court of law when you've got a care team that does maybe one procedure a week out in Wyoming, and they've got the ability to have that telestroke solution. Patient gets on the table. It's a new technology, and the litigious nature and the bottom feeders that ruin healthcare for us on the legal side, well, when there's a less than optimal outcome, the surgeon will say, well, listen, it was better than just letting them die.
Right.
That in itself is a puzzle that's going to have to be navigated. And that's a big fear of mine, is all you need is one of those cases and hospitals are just not going to do that regardless, even though rationally on paper, yeah. it makes sense.
No, that's a very, very real concern. Steve, final question on this, because I want to cover a lot of other things. Is there an opportunity, more of an opportunity for autonomous surgical systems that kind of have a built-in or systems, surgical robotic systems that have a built-in sort of guidance system that elevate the skills of the people on site as opposed to transporting the skills of a specialist from far away, where you get an interventional cardiologist who can remove a clot and just leveling the playing field a bit?
If you go to the ultimate end game, you want to be able to have the skills at the place of care, not reliant on somebody else tele-surgering in. Because again, as Joe says, you know, it just might be that expert's just not available at that critical minute. You know, for these unscheduled cases where it's an emergency, you might not have the person there. And I'm sure we're going to try and work out to have the whole on-call register and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, if you can have the ability for the local teams to be augmented so that their skills become as good as the world's best through augmentation, that probably for many of the things that Joe says, also for legal reasons, timing reasons, network reasons, all of those good things, ultimately what you ideally want is that out in Wyoming, through augmentation, they are as good as the best center anywhere in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. All right, great point. We've taken 10 minutes on the first point, so we're never going to get through this under under an hour if I don't move things along. Joe, you mentioned that you had a moderated endovascular robotics panel. Let's talk a bit about what you saw on that panel, and more broadly, folks can tell me what you saw at the meeting. Yeah. So, Joe, how'd the panel go?
Well, first of all, great for Vip Patel to start expanding out the sort of form factor there, because after a while, if all you're doing is soft tissue robots, it might be, you know, Groundhog Day every year there when you start to look at form factors. And certainly robotic-assisted surgery is critical in nature. But the endovascular side I thought was really interesting. So we had, who did we have there? We had Nanoflex, we had Microbot, we had Sentante, we had Stereotaxis. Mm-hmm. So a really nice panel across the board. Robocath too, don't let me forget that. But what was very clear was on that panel, there was a gap where we had two interventionalists there, Ryan Matter and Adnan Siddiqui, but we didn't have the strategics there. And so my advice to VIP was, love the fact that you had the platforms there. However, without the strategics there who talk about how do we get the imaging in there, because without imaging, you don't have endovascular robots.
Mm-hmm.
And then, is there enough interaction there between a group of surgeons, a group of, or interventionalists, a group of strategics, and the people building the endovascular robots? There needs to be more exchange there, because I'm afraid that a lot of these CEOs that I saw on the panel, great thinkers and great CEOs, but there's a lot of unidimensional thinking going on in those companies. And the big strategics need to be there to make this category happen.
Steve Bell, rebuttal. No. Do you have any insights from Joe's panel or things you heard in the hallway?
Yeah, look, so I think, again, 30,000 feet, the fact that we're even having this discussion now is very encouraging. I think in 2019, we wouldn't be having this discussion. We wouldn't be talking about these robots. I think it's a theme that I saw there, which is this wasn't a surgical Da Vinci-like robotic meeting with three or four clones of Da Vinci. This was about a number of different robots in different categories, different approaches to different things, different segments, you know, including we had some dental in there as well. And this is, I think, is, you know, a real testament to the meeting and to VIP and to the organizers that it's now no longer this just pure surgery play.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just really encouraged that we're even having the discussions. That's number one. Coming to what Joe says, I agree 100%. You can't have these isolated discussions without looking at the whole ecosystem, especially when imaging plays such it's just a critical part in some of the delivery of these robots. So again, I'm in favor as well, where we need to have all stakeholders from the industry, especially, but also, you know, you've got to have the right radiologists, you've got to have the right interventionalists in the room at these panels, just to make sure that we're getting a holistic 360 view of this, because it is complex, and it's going to be very complex to make this all work together in a rational way. So yeah, I agree with Joe that you've got to have everyone at the table.
Yeah, and Tom, just wrapping this subject up a bit, you know, even though they were off in a corner, but they still had big crowds, you had Histosonics there, mm-hmm. and you had Incitec there. So that is part of the next growth of surgery, is incisionless surgery. I had the opportunity to sit with Fred. What's great is it's like Cher, or, you know, everybody knows Fred, right? Fred Moll. And Fred and I were talking.
Fred'll do.
Fred'll do. And I said to Fred, I said, Fred, you kind of are the godfather of this, right? How do you feel about it and where it started? He goes, I don't think about the robot anymore. He said, you know, surgery was as small as an incision I can make with as little stress on the body as I can make and as great access as possible. And then I challenged him. I said, well, what about if we don't have to make an incision? What if we can take energy delivery like a histosonics and not just manipulate tissue or remove tissue, but also prep tissue for an additional therapeutic use on it, which histosonics does, and there'll be some white papers coming out on that. So, and then in the booth next to that was Proximy, right? So what we have to be careful in robotics, Steve, is this, the fatal unconnectedness of the OR. Because if we look at the OR as a series of siloed solutions, and we, again, it's a fatal unconnectedness of looking in an entire system, and that's what was great about having it in Europe was in the US that show has surgeons, healthcare administrators, payers, all at the attention at the booths. At ERCAD, you didn't get that cohort, so people were talking to themselves and more cross communication was happening company to company because you had the opportunity time. So I just see this show and even challenging VIP, it might not stand up anymore as Society of Robotic Surgery. It might have to be something else, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the industry, Intuitive. Steve, you had a great part of your blog post, and the blog is part of your How to Start Up in MedTech platform. People should certainly subscribe. You described it as Intuitive sort of flexing. Dave Rosa, CEO Dave Rosa, was there for the entire time. You commented that the other leaders from larger strategics weren't present, and I think you said the interviews were recorded. They weren't even live interviews. How did Intuitive handle the week? They opened things up again. I had an article with them talking with Brian Miller about telesurgery and his imploring, like, look, we need to find a clinical use for this. We can't just do it because it's neat. It needs to be something surgeons demand. How did you see Intuitive walking through the meeting, and what does the state of where we are with this industry mean for Intuitive? They're still leading, obviously, but any changes in the horse race?
No, look, they do a great job of being a leader in the industry, and you know, they officially launched their Da Vinci 5 for Europe because they got CE mark.
Yep.
That is a big event. I got a feeling there's a lot of hospitals around Europe been waiting for that. There's a little bit of pent up demand for that. So that's interesting. They launched a curved sealer, extend, which is, you know, more advanced energy. They had a very reserved way that they talked about the telesurgery. You know, they want to do it. They don't want to be first. They want to be right. And I found that quite interesting. And they have been involved in telehealth for a long time. Their systems have been able to do that for a long time. But they demonstrated that with some, you know, extra things. They were able to do force feedback over the telesurgery. They were able to do some very nice demonstrations of handoffs and handbacks of the instruments. So you know, they are going to do it right. And my comment about Dave Rosa is that you have the CEO of the company come and spend significant time at the meeting. That is a signal to the industry. It's a signal to the society, and it's a signal to the market. And this isn't a side project for them. This isn't something that they have to do as well as running 15 other things in a company. This is their focus. And it just speaks volumes to me when they turn up there, especially an important thing like an investor's day, when you have all the analysts in the room and you have a lot of important investors in the room, people who put money in their, you know, from their funds into their company. I just think it's the right thing to do. And it just speaks volumes to me on leadership that comes from them.
Joe, how did you interpret Intuitive's stance on telesurgery? They are being cautious. They seem to be pulling back in the reins. Is this maturity talking? Is this experience talking? Is it them trying to just put some cold water on some competitors that are, you know, that seem to be making a lot of news in this space. How do you read that?
What is that? There's a saying that I want to know where and when I'm going to die, so I make sure I don't go there. Right? So with Intuitive, I want to know where and when you're going to beat me, and I'm not going to go there.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the first thing that's to sit on the entry point of every soft tissue surgical robotic is, where and when will Intuitive beat me? Because I don't need to go to that market. Yet some still people are pigheaded trying to go into the OR with their robot.
Mm-hmm.
And so Intuitive doesn't have to solve today the telesurgery problem because they're everywhere anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it actually, you shouldn't be highlighting a capability that potentially could be a threat. Not a big threat, in my opinion. And I think Dave and team will demonstrate that they can do that. If any robotic company can do it, they can do it. And so I think they're doing that. And I think Dave's a different leader than Gary. Dave is a man of the people. Gary, while genius, he was never, you know, the outward facing leadership mm-hmm. CEO. So they're just different people there. And I think Dave is just being a good ambassador in general. I think it's a miss all the other CEOs weren't there. I would not be putting in my top five initiative telesurgery where I spend my money
mm-hmm.
If I was a robotic company. You got other problems to solve there.
Interesting. Let's move into another space that I know you track closely, the ASC market. And it's an opportunity. You've presented it, and Steve has as well, as an opportunity for other surgical robotics companies. Any insights gleaned from SRS regarding what kind of products we may see in that space, how that area may be served?
Yeah, I'm still amazed and frightened for that category that not enough people really see that category being the highest growth percentage in surgery or cath labs or procedures in general. Look, the payers are when you have aligned incentives, and there aren't that many in healthcare, which is why we have issues, but when you have aligned incentives of lower acuity, lower cost,
mm-hmm.
better outcomes, better service being pushed to those, at least in the United States, let's just talk about the US, you ought to be there. Again, going back to tell me where I'm gonna die and I'll make sure I'm never gonna go there. Intuitive's not playing there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you saw Distal Motion double down on it. You saw Moon Surgical double down on it. I believe that people are starting to get it. But even in the endovascular panel that I did, they were ill-equipped to answer the ASC model. And they were still even fumbling with the economic model of they're still thinking CapEx acquisition when ASC is all about OpEx on the balance sheet
mm-hmm.
and surgery is a service mentality. And even all those endovascular CEOs were sort of had the 1,000-yard stare when I brought up ASCs. So that's a little mm-hmm. concerning to me that they are pursuing the technical challenges, but they really aren't looking at the business opportunities.
No, that is concerning. Steve, how do you view it? You were nodding your head through that. I don't know what, you can speak globally, of course. I'm not sure of the ASC situation in Europe, but speaking about the US, and give us any insights on what's going on in your part of the world.
Yeah, no, there is. So interestingly, Smith & Nephew just set up an ASC yep. in the UK.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of model is coming to Europe. And there's equivalent models across Europe with clinics, private clinics. There's even some, you know, surgeon-run clinics around Europe as well. So I think it's equivalent. And Joe nails it, which is the trend is the move to that site of care where possible, you know, right procedure in the right place. What I did see at the meeting was there are some form factors of robots coming out that are quite different. So, if you look across the last couple of weeks, you've had things like Think Surgical, which has come out with a handheld
mm-hmm.
orthopedic total knee arthroplasty robot, handheld. There were, I can never say it, Mendira.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure it out myself. Yeah, I think it's Mendira.
It's Mendira. Yeah. And they've got they've got a handheld percutaneous needle robot. Mm-hmm. You've got handheld central venous catheter. You've got form factors that will fit and play better into that location, size of location, footprint of location, and workflow of location. You know, you're not going to change so much the education of the staff. You just have to give them a sort of a delta training on how to use the system. So I think some people are thinking about it a little bit, but by far, Joe's right, the majority of people are not. They're deep in the tech solution, and they're not thinking of the commercial solution that needs to play into. And I've said this for a lot of companies. They've got to get the commercial side from a financial side right, because the financials in an ASC and a clinic are so different. Mm-hmm. Totally different than anything you'll see in the main healthcare hospitals. But it's also from the commercial of how do you deploy and how do you get your marketing and your sales teams into that space and working in that space and talking to the right people that make the decisions in that space. And I think a lot of companies are very ill-equipped for that.
I would agree with Steve on that. And Steve brings up two points that are aligned here through association. The leadership set this culture that they're so focused on the technical solutions. Yet you've got to back out on this and go to where you're going to die on the cross. Two items. How do you make the commercial acquisition of this work?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And how do you, so that's economics. And then stepping back again on economics is, how do you set cost targets early in the product development side of things? And I will tell you that as I go around and talk to people in the booths, and I start asking them about the technologies and then the R&D, and then tell me about your cost targeting on the product development side, I almost get a cold stare. And so if you can't get those cost targets down and you can't rationalize that OpEx cost to the site of care, you might have one of the best robots in the world, but you're never going to be able to make it economically work, whether you're looking for acquisition or you're a large strategic, and year after year as you stand that up, you're going to be bleeding. And one of my favorite terms I heard was when Auris was bought by J&J, they finally realized that Auris was built to be sold, not to be scaled, their Monarch system. And we ought to study that really closely. The venture money ought to study that really closely, because the VCs, I mean, the strategics are. So that's a call out, especially to the endovascular category more than anybody else, because soft tissue is already baked in. That's where they are.
I think Joe's right there again. And there's two ways that you make that work. And one of it is, you know, you just make the price, let's say a catheter. So you make it single use and you get the price as low down as you can for the cost of making that single use. Or you go for another strategy, which is a little bit like what Intuitive did with their instruments, which is you make them multi-use, but you make them easy to clean and you make it where your cost per case target is really, really low.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really matter which one you end up with. But the one thing I feel is they have to fit into current payments. The ability to change payment structure is so difficult and so impossible. As teams, I would be sitting there saying, okay, they can pay $400 and we need to make X percent margin on this. And therefore, either as a single use or a multi-use or a reusable, whatever it is, the cost per case to us needs to be this, or we don't make the money. And I don't think there's enough thinking of that going on early on in these especially the robotic systems.
So I know we're running up against our time, but just finally, it's a big question, but AI is in sort of the evolution of surgical robotics into digital surgery. It's a much bigger platform. Is AI adding to that tech noise, just making it more of a technical project that's going to even make it more muddled and more difficult for adoption? Or is it the solution that's going to actually make surgical robotics easier to find a home under those reimbursement codes and in traditional healthcare? Is AI the problem, a problem or a solution, Steve?
So I, I think that the dream of where the big AI goes in the future, when we're seeing all these, you know, autonomous surgery and stuff, and the John Hopkins stuff was shown, great and fantasy, and I think it's the right trajectory to go for. I actually was more impressed by some of the early small wins. I talked with a number of surgeons, and they said, oh, you know, we're already using large language models to do things like note-taking, or it's a lot of the small administrative stuff that has just eaten into clinical care and just become the burden of so many care teams. I think the AI there is actually already starting to chip away at that and make that a little bit better. It's still, still to go mass adoption, but I think that's where you're going to see real benefits straight away. The thing about the robots, and we did the Shark Tank, and there was lots of AI at the Shark Tank and stuff like this. My underlying question to all the companies all the time is, who's going to pay for it? What if this will just be a table stake as part of you deliver a robot and it just has to have it? What if it will be an add-on that someone's willing to pay for? What will be a freemium? What will be a premium? And I don't think we've really got that worked out yet as an industry.
Last word to you, Joe.
I agree with Steve. I think the early adoption, which will really help the clinician surgeon a lot, is going to be in the non-FDA regulated efficiency of workflow. So that's one. And people should be excited about that and not rush it. Then you can step into imaging. I think we're going to get early adoption, high adoption on the imaging side of things. And if you slide into robotics, I think you'll get, like the ISU has, that Ascensus has, is use that AI for guidance, tissue characterization, go or no go zones, etc. So those will be super helpful as well. And then finally, on board, in like a Moon has, where they've cleverly put their AI system and their AI agent in their robot looking out into the room, where it's almost like a Trojan horse, because it's going to be offering guidance, insight, agentic AI on advisement on setups and things like that, gathering all the information where others are trying to be in the periphery, putting cameras, trying to negotiate with IT, negotiate on the cyber, coming in. It's a real headache. So I think those are the areas first, but I think we've got years ahead of us from an FDA perspective, just stepping outside of workflow, imaging, and maybe advisement and setups of the system itself.
Fantastic. All right, so I understand SRS 2026 will be in Miami next year, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. So I hope we can do this in person then. You folks, this feels like, I only came to know SRS a few years ago. I went to my first one last year. Again, I regretted missing out on this one. Hearing from you, it sounds like we're taking a generational, an evolutionary step for SRS. This is going to become one of the must-attend meetings. Do you both agree?
Steve?
Yeah. I think if I can only go to one meeting a year, I would go to this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what'll be funny is you're either going to be satisfied with the status quo or frightened by the difficulties of change in the robotics world, and that the bold will be rewarded on the people who move forward in that category.
Fantastic. All right, well, thank you both for easing my regret of not being there this year, and look forward to having additional or future conversations with you both. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Steve.
Cheers, guys.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks to TCAN for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly podcast, and for Emily Stelzer for joining us on our FOMO series. Thanks, of course, to Steve Bell and Joe Mullings for giving us an update on SRS 2025. I hope to do that in person at SRS 2026 in Miami next year. Don't forget to join us at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th. Go to west.devicetalks.com. to register, and don't forget to register for Tuesday's Device Talks Tuesdays, brought to you by Isometric Micro Molding, Fundamental Differences in Miniaturization Focused DFM. Please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network on any major podcast player. And of course, finally, follow me on LinkedIn. I got to catch up to Chris Newmarker. Follow me, follow Kayleen Brown, Follow Chris if you haven't already followed him, but everyone seems to be following him. Do that on LinkedIn. And of course, also follow Device Talks and Mass Device. And please share this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast on your LinkedIn channel. And when you do, make sure you link with me and Chris and Kayleen and Device Talks and Mass Device so we can be part of your future MedTech conversations. All right. Well, once again, that's a wrap. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.